You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
My name's Joe Hallgut and I'm Director of Creative Learning and Development here at the RSA. It's my real pleasure to welcome all of you to this evening's special event. I actually want to start this evening by acknowledging the support of De Bali, which is a wonderful cultural centre in Amsterdam, which is a partner for this event. It was Rick Savecka who introduced the RSA to Jelma and what I call the Flip the System Collective. He also first suggested this event, and he's making sure that lots and lots of teachers in Holland in particular are watching this event. So hello to you in particular, and please tweet your questions in English, please. We hope that this marks a longer partnership between the RSA and De Bali. Tonight's event also marks the start of a longer RSA programme and campaign around teacher empowerment based on the idea around closing creativity gaps amongst learners, teachers and education systems. Whilst education reform across the world focuses rightly on improving teacher quality as a key driver for success, the dominant top-down methods appear to be having diminishing returns and limiting teachers' own agency in these change processes. Building on the RSA's report on teachers' relationship with research and our animation and report on giving teachers a licence to create, our recent work on global school innovation that we did a report with the World Innovation Summit for Education and with the Innovation Unit, called for education systems to become long-term focused, equity-centred, humanising and crucially teacher-powered. So what would it take, in Jelma's words, to flip the system? This afternoon we held a small event in partnership with Ashoka with about 50 teachers and others, and some really good ideas came from that discussion, which I hope audience members can share with us later. But to start this discussion, we're delighted that our keynote speaker is Andy Hargreaves. Andy has got a long title, but the most important thing is he's an Accrington lad. He's the Thomas More Brennan Chair in the Lynch School of Education and Professor of the Carroll School of Management at Boston College. He's written lots and lots of books, advised many governments, and has received many awards for his work. My own thinking about education was really influenced enormously by Andy's thoughts about collective agency and what he describes as a global fourth way of educational change. Tonight, Andy will share his insights with us and then joining the panel to respond to Andy's address and share their experience of this. We're delighted to welcome Fiona Collins and Jelma Evans. Fiona is principal of inner city primary school Francis Street in Dublin, and also an Ashoka Changemaker School. And Jelma is a teacher, learning innovator and author, most importantly, of the essay collection Flip the System, Changing Education from the Ground Up. So, over to you, Andy. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Thank you. Good evening, everyone, and welcome. I want to thank the Royal Society of Arts. I want to thank Education International, Jelma Evers, who's produced this remarkable book, Flip the System, not only for making this evening possible, but really for all you stand for in terms of educational progress, development, and the role of a strong teaching profession. One question I was asked to consider tonight in my brief was, can the creativity of a school exceed the creativity of its teachers? In fact, it came in the negative and as a statement. The creativity of a school cannot exceed the creativity of its teachers. And I'd like to propose this statement is incorrect. It can. It can exceed the creativity of its teachers just as a class can exceed the quality of its students by how you teach them, how you lead them, and how you get them to work together. And the creativity of teachers can be exceeded, but in terms of what they bring into a school or a community, by how creatively those teachers can work together, collectively, not individually, exercising their shared judgment with collective responsibility for all students' success across their classes, across their students, and across their schools. Benjamin Franklin, who has a room downstairs named after him at the Royal Society of Arts, said that investment in knowledge always pays the best interest. Investment in knowledge always pays the best interest. And investment in good teachers and great teaching will give us many happy returns for generations to come in terms of the students we influence, the people they turn into, and the public life to which they contribute over time. My title tonight that has come upon me is a strange one in a piece that has just gone to the Times Educational Supplement for the commentary section is one that may take a slight bit of explanation across different cultures. As a youth and as a child, I was a thing in England called a train spotter. It's usually a term of abuse rather than one of flattery. And a train spotter is somebody who watches trains and knows all about the trains and everything that can be concerned with them. And at the back of the train in England, in Britain, the very last carriage is not called the caboose as it is in North America, and I don't know what it would be in all the other cultures. It's called the guard's van, and the guard's van is where the guard is. The guard's van is the very last carriage of the train. The guard's van is the one that is behind everything else, to be followed only by zero in its wake that it leaves behind. So the subtitle or the non-title of tonight's speech, as well as the one that is formally on paper, is called The Vanguard and the Guard's Van. Two approaches towards developing a teaching profession. And I'll have three ways of talking about this with you. One is, first of all, to share with you a little diagram or organizer about whether we can have a self-directed system as well as a self-improving one. A self-improving system is one, if it works, that will give you greater progress. A self-directing system is one that will make you clearer or more motivated about where it is you want to go. In our educational systems, as in all areas of leadership, we need not only to know how to progress, but also which direction we should be moving in. Secondly, I'll talk about attention in my work that some of you will already know, and it will be quite brief, between two different directions for the future of public education, the future of all education, and the future of the teaching profession. One based on business capital, and one based on professional capital. And I'll outline the distinctions between the two. I think professional capital versus business capital is coming to be in the ascendant, actually, now. And England is behind. But there's a backlash. We need to know what it is. It's intellectual. It makes statements that are derogatory about the teaching profession. And we need to be vigilant and know how to respond. And I'll give three examples of that. And then we will close. Are we in the vanguard or are we in the guard's van? Where do we want to be? Are we self-directing as well as self-improving? And here's a way to think about it. And you're going to get 2 minutes to discuss this amongst yourselves in the audience, or switch off your podcast briefly at home and spend 2 minutes before you switch it back on again. The question is, in terms of where we want to go as a school, as a network, as a system, as a country, is do we want to be less bold? Do we want to focus on things that we can easily specify? Do we want to concentrate on literacy, numeracy, measurable standards, test scores, high school or secondary school graduation and completion? Is this less bold what we want to focus on, or do we want to be more bold? Do we want to be humanistic, to focus on the whole child, to develop creativity, to concentrate on 21st century skills, although I believe there are only two unique 21st century skills. One is digital awareness and the other is global engagement for most people. And all the other so-called 21st century skills have a history of more than a century or two centuries in many cases. So do we want to be bold in what we're seeking, in what we want our children and our society to be? Bold or less bold? Who are you? Where do you want to be? And then do we want to be broad? in terms of how we recognise this or look at it or articulate it to other people? Or do we want to be specific in terms of how we describe it through a clear narrative so that everybody can understand it? In terms of how we monitor the impact of progress, how we know whether we're achieving it as a system or as a community, and in terms of its effects on student learning. Do we want to be broad or do we want to be specific? Four cells, less bold, bold, specific, broad. Where is your school or your country now? Where do you think it is now and where do you want it to be? Reflect for a moment, talk to your partner. I am not going to ask you. You will not share this with anyone else. Reflect and talk to your partner, and we will come back in 2 minutes. Thank you. So hopefully everybody's exploring a little their prior knowledge and connecting it to your own perceptions of your own experience now as you hear what comes next. I've just stepped off a plane from Boston, and so there are only two available modes for me to communicate with you. One is hyperactive, and the other is comatose. And there's nothing in between. So probably you're going to get hyperactive, and I will try and avoid the comatose. Let's go to the top left-hand cell, less bold and specific. Here are some of the usual suspects you might expect to see there. England, the federal policy until 1 month ago of the United States. And Sweden, until less than a year ago, and a change of government. What Pasi Solberg calls the global education reform movement. Places that have relatively narrow and specific goals that are easily measurable in literacy, numeracy, conventional subjects, examinations, and calibrated in a very specific way, usually also within a market system of competitive choice around the specifically designed standards. It's a comfortable place for people to be. The criticism of it is that it also is not only specific, but also comes with punitive accompaniments in terms of accountability, firing of principals, closing of schools, exposure of head teachers, school students in cultures of blame and shame. Less expected up in this top left-hand cell is Ontario. And in Ontario, the narrative until very recently, which has been very attractive to other systems, is that they also have focused on literacy, numeracy, high school graduation. They focused on raising the bar, narrowing the gap on three basic priorities that are easily measured by standardized test results at two grade points, but that it is not punitive in the way that, say, England has been or the United States has been. That there's support instead of pressure. And there's been measurable progress in a number, but not all of these areas. For instance, in literacy, but not in mathematics. In some areas of equity, but not in all areas of equity. This is where Ontario has been until very recently for the best part of 10 years. So what's next? This is where Ontario's going now. Ontario is actually grappling now with the next level or the next direction that it wants to take. Under its Premier, Kathleen Wynne, who has spent her former career with Indigenous communities before she went into politics, and is the first openly gay leader at that level in North America, she cares passionately about equity and passionately about students' well-being and identity, all students' well-being and identity. So Ontario now is about achieving excellence, but including creativity, 21st century skills, a range of school subjects, arts, many more things on literacy and numeracy. Many kinds of equity, Indigenous students in special education, students in poverty, well-being, positive well-being, not just avoiding negative well-being and its connection to achievement and learning, and still somehow in the midst of all this, trying to enhance public confidence. And it's not just Ontario that's moving in this direction. Norway, where I was just a few weeks ago, is focusing on a range of subject knowledge, learning and metacognition, communicating, collaborating, participating, exploring, inquiring, creating, not just anymore literacy and numeracy in tight, narrow, specific areas. And where did Norway get a lot of its ideas from? Scotland, because they communicate very, very closely with each other. Scotland is in the vanguard of educational change, and I was thrilled to be able, at the second half of last year, with the OECD, to do a country review of Scotland, four of us, particularly looking at their curriculum for excellence that includes interdisciplinary projects, a whole child focus, an entitlement of every child to out-of-school learning as well as in-school learning, no matter where they live, even in the inner city. Successful learners, confident individuals who can articulate their learning, effective contributors and responsible citizens in their community and in their society. This is the direction many systems are going. You look and you'll often see there are four things. They read differently, but they're no longer just about the basic skills and the easily measurable things. And this is Nicola Sturgeon. This is the closest I'll ever get to Nicola Sturgeon. For those who are looking at the picture, she is the awesome First Minister of Scotland. And when she speaks, she speaks about things like the importance of having a more coherent national assessment framework, not a standardised testing framework, but more coherent. But time and again, she repeats the importance of professional judgment as the cornerstone of the success of the Scottish educational system. One that is supported by a report in 2011 called Teaching Scotland's Future. One that's enshrined in the standards that are defined by the profession and not by the government, by the General Teaching Council of Scotland. One that is enshrined in the large number of teachers taking master's degrees. We found 12 of them in one secondary school alone, all funded by the local authority, local community. A society where almost every child goes to the same public or state schools, where every parent is invested in all of the system. It's not a war of all against all, school against school, parent against parent, child against child. Where teacher education is university-based, closely tied to good practice in partnerships with local schools. There's no teach first, do something better later here. Scotland is in the vanguard of educational change with a strong, professionally run system. England is in the guards van. Thank you for that one piece of applause there. I will pay you later. So this is quite interesting. Ontario and Scotland are trying to move to the same corner. To be bold, but also to be specific. To be specific means you're not all over the place, you have a clear narrative and it's shared together. To be specific means if you value joy, you'd know when you have it and you'd be able to articulate it to other people. To be specific means all the things you want for your students, you'll be clear about when you're having them and be able to demonstrate to other people you're achieving them, not only, but also including the basics of literacy and numeracy. Bold and specific is the corner to go. And to do that, we need to avoid some other things. We need to avoid the bottom right-hand corner. These are people who are broad and bold and wish to be more specific, but are in danger of sacrificing being bold because they think they're copying systems like Ontario, but they're copying stereotypes of systems like Ontario. Instead, so they're focusing on specific things that are measurable and sacrificing what is important in their boldness as a result of doing that. And instead of copying Ontario, the Netherlands, Denmark, and Wales, though not Wales now because it's shifted, are in danger of becoming the new Volkswagens of educational change, who know simply only how to perform well on a test and have lost their environmental soul in order to do it effectively. With all apologies to people who own Volkswagens and love them, okay? So, that's the first thing. Where are we going? Where do we want to be? How do we specific and clear and shared about how we're doing it? Second, to do this, we need to think about two contrasting views of the teaching profession. This will be quite quick, and you can read the book by Michael Fullan and I called Professional Capital if you want to follow this up in more detail. But the alternatives are either we support a business capital view, that's what we invest in for the future, where the purpose of public education is to yield short-term profits for its investors by running schools for profit, by making money off technological products, by lowering the cost of teaching, by making it simple, short-term, easy to acquire, easy to master, driven by data, not by judgment, just reliant on native wit, enthusiasm, hard work, raw talent, and easily and often replaced by online instruction. This is the business capital view, and it leads to a simple view of teaching that may be suitable for low-level skills, but not suitable for the demanding things we want our young people to be and that they want to be in the society of this century. The opposite is what Michael Fullan and I call professional capital. And a professional capital view is we still invest in teaching, but we're investing in teaching, high-quality teaching, for all young people, based on what the returns that teachers and students will get in the generations that those students form in the future. As the French sociologist Emile Durkheim said, in education, uniquely, those of us who teach, we create the generations of the future. In professional capital, teaching's hard, not easy, technically hard, as well as emotionally hard. It requires high levels and long periods of training, just like all other professions. You're constantly improving. You don't get hold of it after 2 or 3 years, and then you can move on to something else. It needs wise judgment, informed but not driven by evidence and data. It's something we do together, not something we do by ourselves. And it uses technology, but it is not dominated by the technology. This is the second thing. Do we want a view of the future of teaching on those who they teach that is built on the low-cost, short-term returns of business capital or the long-term, high-quality returns of professional capital? And professional capital, we think, some of us, is in the ascendancy at the moment. It's gaining ground because of the complexity of what teachers have to teach, the demandingness of what societies want, and the level of quality and training and development that that will require. So we are seeing a backlash because it is gaining ground. And the backlash comes from three areas. And we need to be vigilant, we need to be knowledgeable, and we need to realise it is not accidental or incidental. Here are the three kinds of response. One is, teachers already get too much. The Department of Education here has in 2013 and then in 2016 in England produced guides for metrics to measure teacher and school efficiency through value-added calculations. I don't know if you've seen these, but the point is to say, in the definition of teacher efficiency, how can we produce the same output with lower levels of input? We may not be able to lift the standard, but at least we can make achieving the standard more cheap. About 18 months ago, an international report also measured teacher efficiency in different countries, finding out who reached the same standards at lower costs. Lord Adonis wrote an introduction to this document produced by three people, none of whom were educators. One of the many conclusions was that, judging by the data, if salaries in Switzerland were lowered by 48.5% and class sizes were maintained at the same level, Switzerland would have a chance of performing as well as Finland on the international PISA scores. I'm just checking you're listening to that. And Canada just recently did one just a few months ago comparing high-performing provinces. It took the four highest-performing provinces and compared the costs against each other and then recommended that salaries in three of them be lowered to the lowest level of one of those four equally high-performing provinces. We may not be able to raise the standard, but at least we can make it more cheap. And nobody thinks, of course, what this would do to teacher recruitment or teacher morale if you suddenly lowered salaries by 48.5%, for example. Although if you live in Ireland, you probably know how that already feels, as I'm addressing one of my panellists, one of our panellists, who will follow. Second part of... So those are three different reports, all on the same theme. The second one is that professional development is a waste of money. And the New Teacher Project in the United States produced a report on exactly this in the last few months, where it looked at the research, including research it collected itself on professional development, and concluded that pretty much there are no large-scale demonstrable effects of professional development on student learning. Now, bear in mind, this is in the United States, where the overall quality of professional development is pretty poor, with what they call one-shot deals and fly-by workshops. And as a result of saying there's no evidence, the report then reached a remarkable conclusion, which is that professional development should be linked to consequences. Professional development should be linked to rewards and sanctions. Professional development should be linked to different kinds of compensation that would motivate greater improvement. After doing extensive research that they claim shows no relationship of professional development to anything, the report jumps to a market-based driven conclusion of extrinsic incentives, reward and sanctions as a way of rewarding or removing teachers in relation to the profession. These are not accidental. Third is a report from England called Collaborative Overreach that some of you may have read very recently by a London-based centre for market-based approaches to schooling and education. And this report summarises the research on collaboration, concluding that professionally it is largely overvalued, overrated, and many forms of it are ineffective. But when you look at the report specifically, it only talks about school-to-school collaboration. And of course, it is quite reasonable to say that some forms of collaboration are more or less effective than other forms, and we need to be clearer about those kinds that are most effective. In this country, Chris Chapman, now living in Scotland, which is a unifying theme here, Chris Chapman has concluded that federations of schools that focus more closely on the learning outcomes they share in common are more likely to be effective than those that just vaguely share practice with each other. So this is fair enough. But the report then concludes that in the future, collaboration is not only commensurate with competition, but the major future is one that should be defined by competition, in which collaboration is one component. So we see three lines or fronts of attack in response to the resurgence of professional capital and the idea of a strong teaching profession. One is to lower the cost of teaching, because many teachers already get too much. Second is to rethink professional development as teacher evaluation. And third is to pull back on the investment in social capital and teachers working together in favour of a market-based competitive system. I've tried this evening, in this short time, to talk about it's how teachers work together as a profession, where the future of our children and our educational system lies. I've tried to talk about the fact that direction on which way we want to go, to be bold, to be demanding, to be complex, as important, is as important as the degree of progress we make in pursuing that direction. I've opposed the alternatives of a business capital model driven by the market and by lowering costs versus a professional capital model that will yield many happy returns for years to come. We are in the building where Benjamin Franklin has his own room, though he may or may not be aware of it at this point. Just remember, investment in knowledge always pays the best interest. An investment in a strong teaching profession where teachers have not only individual autonomy and individual judgment, but collective autonomy and collective judgment is one of the most powerful ways in which we can create a better future for all the generations that we influence. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Andy. That was fascinating, and I would love to wade in, especially about Scotland. That may come later. But for the moment, let's turn to our panellists, starting with Fiona. Thank you.
Hi. Fabulous to be here and to meet Andy. I remember learning all about Andy theories when I was in college, which doesn't seem like it was that long ago, but obviously it must have been. I'm a principal of a school in Dublin, which is an inner city primary school, and I'm just going to take a little bit of what I heard today and also from what Andy spoke about and kind of give my own perspective from the context of an Irish school, but also the context of a school in a very deprived area. And something I want to talk about is something called emotional labour and the emotional labour in schools. And there's a positive and there's a negative. The emotional labour in my school is teacher stress and teachers dealing with the sharpness of poverty, the issues of migration, the issues of depravity and socioeconomic deprivation that surrounds my community, my children, my teachers, and how my teachers cope with that stress. There is no support, but teachers are burnt out. And a huge part of my job and my role has been motivating these teachers and turning the concept of emotional labour from a negative into a positive. And how I did that was by reinventing or recreating the curriculum. The curriculum in Ireland is a national, standardised, centralised curriculum that's quite rigid, where there was no component for wellness, there was no component for the wellness of children or the wellness of teachers or the people delivering a wellness curriculum. And we invented our own based on social and emotional learning. Through this, we changed the behaviour of the children in our school, but we also changed the behaviour of our teachers. Our teachers became far more empowered because, first of all, they understood why the children were behaving the way that they were behaving, but also the strategies that we were using to impact and improve that they were using on themselves to create change. This created a system of collaborative learning where they no longer felt that they were delivering something that was nothing to do with the context of the community in which they were working, but they created it themselves. And I saw a massive change in my school where we had long-term goals, and the long-term goals were preventing our children ending up in prison, but we had short-term interesting initiatives that empowered the entire community to prevent our children ending up within the social justice system. And what this did, in building on what Andy says, is it enhanced the professional capital of our teachers. And this professional capital was something that I kind of felt, you know, the media were really, really down on our schools and down on our teachers in deprived areas because essentially they were punch bags for what was going on. They weren't curing the ills of society, and this was affecting them. And it was with this building of the professional capital that I saw there was a massive change in this. And, you know, Andy was talking about kind of a system of collaborative learning. We were out on our own. You know, a lot of the schools in Ireland are all very same. They all sing from the same hymn sheet until we were nominated and chosen as an Ashoka Changemaker school. And all of a sudden, for the first time in my professional life, was I surrounded by five other peers who had the same impetus for change that I have. And I saw how this changed my own attitude and gave me confidence. And then I brought this to my teachers and my school. We're now all of a sudden a school where I first started, where there were five teachers and we couldn't hold a teacher longer than 3 months. I'm getting emails from teachers wanting to teach in my school simply by taking the concept of emotional labour and turning it from a negative into a positive and building the professional capital of my teachers within that remit.
Thanks, Fiona. Gentlemen.
Yes, thank you. Well, of course, Andy's the story really resonated with me. He was one of the inspirations for writing Flip the System, which is a book written by teachers and researchers internationally, and it's based on a Dutch book we wrote, edited together with René Kneiber and lots of other Dutch teachers. Het Alternatief, The Alternative, which together with loads of other, I think, trends and organizations, but also individual teachers and also more progressive but also more traditional teacher organizations, gave sort of like a voice to that we thought was going wrong. I agree with Andy that we were very broad and unfocused, germ light, as René likes to call it. He's my co-author. So we did have some measures there that were going wrong, but increasingly everything that came out of the Department of Education was quite worrying, and I think it was in reports on value-added metrics by the Department of Education which actually sort of like formed the catalyst to start writing the book. So we asked loads of different people to reflect on our education system, so especially also teachers. About 50% of the book was written by teachers, but also Andy on professional capital, which was a really pivotal piece, but also Gert Biesta on really reflecting on the purpose of education. And it was, I think, that combined voice of really deep reflection by teachers, but also research-informed and also in a broader international scope, that gave it sort of like a voice to a broader movement that was already there. And we specifically also campaigned around it. We call it Flip the System, and it's essentially two things. It's also based on professional capital. What has been happening has also been happening because of the teachers have let this happen. We didn't take the initiative ourselves. So Thijs Jansen, one of the contributors, calls that voluntary slavery. So we've been following along with the system, not questioning what we're doing, not thinking of new paradigms, and that's what we are trying to do. And at the same time, lots of people are saying there's lots of space in the Dutch educational system, so why aren't you doing this? And I'm teaching at a really progressive school, UNIC, and when you are at the boundaries become really clear. And lots of things that people were saying were possible weren't possible. So it's essentially, it's all of those things combined. And it has led, I think, to a complete change of discourse in the Netherlands in the last 2-3 years. Loads of teachers have taken initiatives on all different levels, on inspectorates, on teacher professionalism, finding sort of like a common ground between traditional teachers and more progressive teachers, that we agree to disagree, but we agree on each other's professionalism. And that is, I think, the way forward. So it's the combined dialogue and the professional capital that derives from that, together with inspectors, together with board members, together with school leaders and teachers, that forms a new paradigm. And it allows teachers and everyone, I think, in the system to take responsibility again. And so it's not outsource it to some metric or some spreadsheet or some other thing that we use. You need to be data-informed but not data-driven. And if you design the system in such a way and design schools in such a way and empower teachers, so not like some make-believe empowerment, then the teachers and we ourselves can't hide anymore as well behind the system. We really have to take responsibility on every level. And a good example of that are the teacher-powered schools in the United States, which have transformed themselves into educational cooperatives, schools as a cooperative. So on every level, within the schools themselves, teacher empowerment, within the system itself, teacher empowerment, and of course, it's still up in the air where we're going with the Netherlands, but the transformation that we've seen the last 2 years and the direction where I think we are heading in the long run is that we're moving towards the one that we want to be in, specific and bold. And that's something I would never have dreamt 2 years ago. And I think it shows if teachers and all everybody that cares about education really combine and really build alliances, then you can change the system. And that's the message that we wanted to bring across in our book as well, and the lessons from the Netherlands on an international level.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks. I'll limit myself to just a couple of questions, and then we'll take questions from all of you. Andy, I think the backlash, it may be more subtle than you're saying, because for me, governments, not just in England but across the world, seem to talk the language of professional capital but then take the actions of business capital. And we see, certainly in England, the gap between the rhetoric around freedom and professional judgment and the reality of what governments do non-stop to interfere. If Nicola Sturgeon is the exception, that's fantastic, but she is the exception. And my question is there anything we can... Is that inevitable? Is that just the way politics works? Is there anything we can actually do about that to challenge that?
I think we're in the middle of a very great struggle now, actually, Jill, and where these forces are contending with each other, and they... The American word is the default position will always be to go back to something that is specific, easily measurable, and less bold in many countries. So exactly the kind of collective action that other members of this panel have been describing is so desperately important. And in that, it's really vital to recognize that in arguing for greater teacher freedom and professional autonomy, it is not the autonomy of the individual, but it is the autonomy of teachers from bureaucracy, but less autonomy from each other. So the importance of teaching now, which is a challenge for teachers in some cultures and countries, including in Ontario, where I'm currently one of four advisors to the Premier, is we have a huge discussion with the teaching profession now about two words, collaborative professionalism. And the teachers who have been in a year of various kinds of industrial action are afraid that collaborative professionalism will mean that administrators will tell them what to collaborate on. And administrators are afraid that in collaborative professionalism, they'll have no leadership anymore, and teachers will tell them what to do. So within ourselves, I think we have to struggle for a different and better definition of autonomy than simply the license or freedom to do as we wish as individuals.
Thanks. Any responses to that question?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, we're of course right in the middle of this, and we're struggling with that in our own school as well. We've introduced a new sort of like peer collaboration model, leerkracht, learning power, and it's really transforming Dutch education. It's working really well, but you really have to learn it, and you have to have the time to develop the skills to do it and the security. So one of the things that I think we found in the Netherlands is that we also have to really look at teacher agency. So it's underdeveloped in lots of cases, and I can speak from my own experience as well. So you really have to find the time, create the support structures, and we've introduced a Dutch sort of like a teacher innovation fund, but it has to be networked. Yeah, you have to collaborate on it, and that's sort of like one of the only prerequisites that we do have, but that's how you create the conversations, learn from one another, open up the classroom door. So that's not something that happens overnight. That's something you really have to strive for, I think, really purposefully. Yeah.
Thanks, Fiona. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I suppose a lot of it boils down to fear and the courage to embrace change. And I think I very much notice in my own school, my teachers are so, you know, burnt out by the system that they don't have the energy to create any sort of change. And I think that can be exploited. I think, you know, teachers are so good at making do and plugging holes. And the reality, they're making do with systems and systemic issues that are far greater than what they can deal with. So they're just put down and kept down. And I think it's kind of acknowledging and having a vision of how to break that kind of fear and cultivate again a creativity within our profession that only then will we break away from kind of what's expected in terms of government-derived business models into kind of more creative professional models, I think.
Thank you, Fiona. I'll leave my second question until later. Let's take questions from the floor straight away.
I was really impressed by what you said about data and 21st century skills, Andy. I think that needs saying a lot more loudly and a lot more frequently. But I would challenge you very strongly on what you had to say about Scotland. I worked in Scotland for 18 months when the Curriculum for Excellence was being designed. You didn't say it's the most overtly politicised curriculum imaginable. I wouldn't want to be a very creative teacher working in that environment unless I was completely in line with the dominant ideology. It's quite a different environment, I think, up there. And I wouldn't put it in the bold sector at all.
Certainly not in the performance vanguard by PISA scores, that's for sure, as well. Do you want to come back to that, Andy? Should we take another one first?
First of all, I'd just ask you to read the OECD review, which is as critical as it is supportive. So the task of the report is to help Scotland move ahead and to implement effectively and inclusively what it's been seeking to do with Curriculum for Excellence. So, you know, just four to five random things is to have more coherence in its assessment strategy nationally, to be able to demonstrate progress, to have a narrative that the public understands as well as the profession, for the local authorities to collaborate more closely together, for there to be other kinds of collaboration, for instance, supported by government in the teacher unions or the General Teaching Council or other areas as well as the local authorities. So we think there's massive areas for growth, but in intent and in the early foundation, it's a good beginning.
So, Stavros Yanouka, Chief Executive of WISE. My question has to do with your 2x2, Andy. And I'm thinking of the context of Qatar's education system, for example, where you have a system there that's struggling to get the basics right. And I'm just wondering if what you've shown us there, particularly with the example of Ontario, suggests that it's a journey, that education systems need to start by being perhaps less bold and specific before they can migrate across to that top right-hand corner that everyone seems to agree we need to get to. Just love your views on that.
Thank you. Question again from Mr. Hargreaves. What role do you think teaching unions have had in overseeing or participating in the deprofessionalisation of teachers in the past few decades, and what role might they have yet to play in the reprofessionalising of teachers in terms of your wording there of collaborative professional capital? Thank you.
A quick answer to the first question, probably quicker than you deserve, but I think the things you're describing, the physicists would call vector and thrust. As I'm told by physicists, contrary to some very influential people in policy who think there's a single continuum, if you have in mind different directions, it's more than one path of progress, which is a rather simplistic view that some have put forward of economic development. So, for example, there's good evidence from Latin America, from Mexico and Colombia, with very large numbers of schools, that one very good way to improve practice is not by prescribing simple things for underqualified teachers to do and make them comply till they get better, but rather to find out what teachers can already do. And in a culture that owes more to Paulo Freire than probably it does to anybody else, then to get them to circulate and share what it is that, because everybody knows something, and then to circulate that around more effectively. So, you know, vector and thrust, but no single pathway. And it's an open question, which is better where. And the other question, does somebody else want to, because I'm talking too much, does somebody else want to have a go at number two?
Well, it reminds me of what they did in Amsterdam. They had a sort of like an initiative to, there were lots of weak schools, and I think there was a big problem in our capital. So the county did something that most of our municipalities don't do. They directly intervened with their sort of an initiative, and it worked really well for about 1 or 2 years. And then they continued it, but it came really, it was quite top down, and there were some really professional capital things in there as well, but they should have stopped there, and they continued on that path, and there was lots of pushback by teachers. They really felt disenfranchised after about 2 years. So everybody knew there was a problem, and that they needed to raise standards and more collaboration, but it became, this outside consultancy bureau, which actually didn't move it towards the next level. So you have to be really, I think it works for a really short time, and then you really have to find new ways of collaborating and actually empowering people. And I think that's the line that most people usually don't get when they start changing systems.
Fiona, I mean, you were in that situation really within your school, a school in real difficulties, that you didn't just adopt the kind of prescribed model to change. So.
No, because if we adopted the prescribed model, we would have failed. Mm. I think, you know, what we have to do is, and we have to talk about the children here and what the children need, and I think it's adapting things to suit their context for them to achieve, for them to get on well in the world, I think.
Great, thanks. And back to the question in the back about teacher unions and reprofessionalisation.
Yeah, I think that, that there's two words that are very close to each other that we can easily confuse. On one is professional as an adjective, and the other is aprofessional as a noun. And sometimes they contradict each other. So some of the ways we've tried to increase the idea of being aprofessional in the past have been quite disconnected from practice. They've been about collecting pieces of paper or going on courses, but not necessarily things that make you higher quality within the classroom. And being professional is about what you do and who you are, as well as the status that you have. Because of the excesses of being aprofessional and putting too much emphasis on things you acquire outside the classroom, I think in some ways we placed ourselves under easy attack as a teaching profession from our opponents, and then in many countries went into a long period, as you've said, of deprofessionalisation. And somehow we need to get those two things back together to think about the quality of what we do that benefits the students and pupils that we teach, which at the same time will also elevate our status and standing in the wider community.
And there's something that unions can do specifically in that context?
Unions can and do a lot in that context. I mean, one of the best examples that Yelmer and I know, for instance, is the Alberta Teachers Association, one of the highest performing systems in the world, where there's a single union that also includes all the district administrators and all the school principals. So it's not the teaching profession, it's the education profession, with administrators and teachers not at loggerheads with each other, but working together for a common good. And the union spends about 50% of its budget on research, professional development, and policy advocacy, whereas in many other places, about 98% goes on negotiation and collective bargaining, with about 2% left over for professional development, inquiry, and learning. And I think one thing unions can do is really think hard everywhere they are about how to recalibrate that.
Thank you. Any points from you about the role of unions?
Yeah,
in the
I completely agree. In the Netherlands, they really focused on time, pay, and all those kind of things, which are important, but you lost the narrative, and it was really easy to lose the narrative as well. So what the unions did also the last couple of years, embraced that professional discussion and focused on what education was for and what we needed for that. And so it was a reframing of the discussion. And if you immediately push unions out, you lose a huge percentage of your teachers as well. So I think the whole discussion should be inclusive, and what role can they play to support the educational system instead of just going at each other's throats, which happens in lots of places, and it happened in the Netherlands in 2012 as well. But I think where we are right now is sort of like we've reestablished trust, and say we, the unions did that, the government did that, and we're not that there by a long shot, but we wouldn't have been where we are right now, changing the narrative and also really changing the educational system without that inclusive look, but also without with the unions taking a more really what Andy's saying, professional outlook on what the teaching profession is, instead of just a really narrow focus on time and pay.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree exactly with what you're saying. I suppose traditionally the unions were fighting for you know, issues around cutbacks, pay, things like that, and I think we're reshaping and reframing the function of unions. I think what's been really interesting tonight, and what was really interesting that I found today, when there was lots of different stakeholders from the education communities through in every country in the world in the one room, is that we have the same issues globally. You know, teachers and systems, there's all these short-term reforms, there's issues around cutbacks, resources, things like that. And what I think it's time that there's a revolution, and there's a revolution with Flip the System, there's a revolution with professional capital, there's a revolution with Ashoka, there's a revolution with all of us here today, where there has been no golden age for us to look back on. We're going to start reshaping and reframing the future, and I think it's starting today, and it did start today as far as I can see. So I had such a good day today. So
let's have some revolutionary questions from the floor again. Let's have those two.
Good evening. This has been really interesting. I've been quite surprised that no one's talked about the College of Teaching and the role that that might play, and also some of the challenges it might face. I was really interested by your point, Yelma, about the kind of traditional versus progressive possible false dichotomy, I might argue, and I wonder whether that's something that is as big an issue in the Netherlands as I found it can be here, with people being quite negative about each other and not seeming to accept any kind of middle ground.
Hi, Charlotte Davis, Fit to Learn. All the time I hear about debate on teaching and improving it, what I'm hearing about is teachers, administrators, teachers, and often teachers are being failed. And what we're not looking at really critically is what makes an effective learner. And I think if we came to an understanding of that, it'd be much easier for teachers to teach.
I can think of no other profession than teachers that are constantly under scrutiny globally, and that people actually expect them to change the world. We don't expect the social workers or the doctors to empower the world and the youth, but we expect teachers to do that. So at the same time, they're already under a lot of political and economic pressure. There's this huge pressure that no other profession that I can think of is subject to. How do you manage this at the school level? And what sort of human dynamics play out there that we never hear of in this technical jargon, technical development and academic jargon? Because when you listen to teachers, you don't hear any of this. They sometimes have so basic needs that are not met, that one thinks that actually we need a total paradigm change in how we work with the teachers. And you two being in schools, I want to really know your insight about that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I have a question for Fiona. How do you share your good practice with other schools?
That's an interesting question, because I suppose traditionally, and we're talking about kind of the sense of competition that drives the education system in Ireland, because the more pupils you have, the more money you have, the more pupils you have, the better results your school is getting. So people don't share their ideas, because if you do, then you might lose pupils, you might lose money, etc., and the list goes on. And I don't agree with that, because first of all, I'm in the type of school where, you know, as I was saying earlier, we're not looking, it's not results driven as such. It's kind of more socioeconomic kind of a system where I'm literally trying to prevent my children from ending up in prison. So I have a different kind of philosophy and different kind of aims and goals as well as educationally. But the schools that I work in, we really work collaboratively. We get together, we have the same families, we share the same practices, we have the same issues with teachers, we have the same problems. And there is just an understanding of sharing of ideas, because together we can make far more of a difference to our community than when we work individually. It's literally as simply as that. But then just in terms of sharing ideas, and we were speaking today about Ashoka, and it's through Ashoka and the Changemaker Schools programme where we can really share ideas, and where I particularly have learned so much from other schools and other schools in other countries and jurisdictions.
Jim?
Yeah, it's a really good question on the professional standards and the teacher. I've been following it from online, the whole debate. What we did in the Netherlands, unions and subject organizations and some other teacher organizations forming a teacher cooperative, and that is becoming our professional body, so to speak. Then we are setting up our own standards. I think what has allowed that is that it has become an independent voice, and sort of like a conduit for a teacher voice as well. It's not perfect by a long shot, and there's lots of issues involved still. For example, next year the government mandated a registry for teachers. While who's setting the standards is still unclear. So that's really problematic, and I think they should have let it run its course, and there's this evolution going on where I think most people will be involved in that space, and it is far more productive. But by having all those different teacher organizations on board, you already have a space where all the teachers can at least have their own say, have their own internal debate. There is a very traditional organization on board. I can be a traditional teacher sometimes when the needs be. So I don't really understand the dichotomy between really traditional and really progressive, but I understand where it's coming from. I speak both languages, I think, and I think at least for most teachers and most organizations, we've moved beyond that discussion. This discussion is still there, but I think our combined professionalism is more important now. If you really want to have a teacher voice, and you can have as much debate as you want on how to teach, and it's never going to go away. We've been doing it for about 200 years, and I think we're going to continue doing it for 200 years and longer probably. So that's not a discussion you're going to win. And if teachers focus on just that, they're going to lose out to all the other voices that Andy just talked about. And to me, there's a real danger there if we don't do that. So that's why we also wrote an international version, and we're going to see if we can get a sort of like a guideline on professional standards and how to activate the profession and teaching profession around that. Because one of the things that really worries me is that we'll get the pendulums will swing the other way again. So I want to inoculate, we want to inoculate the Dutch system by having an international teacher voice, including the unions, including everybody that's involved. But if we don't do that, we always lose out. So the way the UK discussion is heading is a dead end, the way I see it right now. And people really should focus on something like a teacher college and how that should run out. That's always discussed nationally. And the Netherlands is different from the UK. But the solution lies there. I think I'm pretty certain about that.
I agree. I think there's grounds for a really powerful consensus to emerge from this. Thank you. Andy?
Yeah, thanks, Joe. Thank you for the question on effective learning and thinking about how we address effectiveness in working with all the learners in our community. One of the things we are doing in Ontario now is there are 72 school districts like local authorities. And with our team at Boston College, we're working with 10 of those. So we can figure out together how to make progress on the very broad government priorities. And one of the things that is very clear in our belief and action system is that you cannot address student engagement without addressing teacher engagement. You cannot, as I think Fiona's made really clear, you cannot develop students' well-being unless you also pay attention to teachers' well-being. If you want to consider aspects of students' identity, things that affect their achievements so much, whether they're indigenous or transnational, they feel they belong to two cultures and families and places at the same time. What we also have to think about and use it as a resource, not just a problem, teachers' identity too. All these things are connected to learning and achievement. We uplift the people we serve by uplifting the people who serve them. That is the challenge, not browbeating the people, you know, our teachers, in order to serve the students better, but seeing a kind of consistency between the two. And one way we can do that, to relate to the question about having to do it all, is by, as I think England did very well until a few years ago, is by having, and was a pioneer in really, is by having more people around the teacher, inside and outside the school, to support their ability to meet the needs of all their students effectively. So both these things, I think, are really tightly connected. And unfortunately, in an age of austerity, many governments decide that all those other adult supports for the teacher are the most expendable, and teachers are left alone. And very poor consequences often follow from that.
Thank you. Thanks, Andy. We uplift the people we serve by uplifting the people who serve them. That's a very, very, very powerful message. Thank you. I'd like to thank our audience at a moment. I wish we had more time. I wish I had more time to talk about RSA's programmes and what we're doing with our academies and so on. Instead of that, I'll just do a brief plug for a report we have out today about how you build creative capacities in schools amongst learners and teachers. It's only 8 pages long. It's got 12 design principles for how you do this in schools, and has 5 ways to get involved with RSA's programmes. So please download that, tell us what you think, and hopefully you can connect with us over the year ahead. Before we all go, I'd just like to ask to thank all our great panellists and Andy for a terrific contribution. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.